Today's Teisho is on Case 50 in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 50 is entitled Umon's Particle After Particles Samadhi. Engo's Introduction. Transcending all ranks, rising above all expedience. Spirit corresponding to spirit, words answering with words. Unless he has undergone the great emancipation and attained the great use of it, how could he rank with the Buddhas and be a faultless exponent of the teachings? Now tell me, who could be so direct and adaptable to all occasions and have the free command of transcendent words? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Umon, what is particle after particle's samadhi? Umon said, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Secho's verse, rice in the bowl, water in the pail, even the most talkative can add nothing. The north and the south stars do not change places. Heaven-touching waves arise on land. If you doubt, if you hesitate, though heir to millions, trouserless. This is day four of our August session. And, if this is your first experience of session, and if you're new to Zen in general, all of this might seem a little strange. The strangest thing might just seem, it might just be that people sit for so long without moving. But this is very important. We people in the West have a kind of antibody attitude, actually. We tend to think of spirit as outside or away from the body. And we think of mind as separate from the body. And we tend to think of the body as crude, animalistic, and so on. A lot of things in our culture encourage us to live that way. We live very far from our bodies. I would say, when it's hot, as it has been, and it's humid, and you sweat, you're very aware of being hot and sweaty, and you become aware of your body, actually. It's cool, you have like an air conditioner on. You makes your body kind of disappear. You're no longer sort of having to be aware of your body. It's even the case that in some religious traditions, people imagine life after death as being like a spirit life where one doesn't have a body. But in Buddhism and in Eastern traditions generally, this idea is very strange. In fact, most places on earth don't think this way. The traditions that come out of India and China, the body is really, really precious. And the body is what basically makes it possible to be alive. In Buddhism, we believe that the body is like an instrument, you could say, for producing enlightenment. So it's like body is this embodiment is this great opportunity, this great adventure to be fully alive. and to be enlightened, actually. You know, so having a body is very precious, and the body itself is like the gateway into enlightenment. So this is so different from the way Western people think. So, you know, we Western people tend to live very far from our bodies, and I'm often struck by how difficult it is, you know, for beginners, myself included. You know, when I was a beginner in Zen, it's very difficult for me to sit on a mat. I was very inflexible. I used to run track, and my muscles were very tight, and it was hard for me to be flexible. And when I started doing Zen meditation, you know, I was very, very interested in meditation. And I was really helped by it. And I had read books on Buddhism, and I was very sold on many of the concepts in Buddhism. But I had a very hard time meditating on a cushion. I was very inflexible. It was very difficult for me. And I remember in the early years of my practice, I thought to myself, I will just go along with this because this is, basically a Japanese tradition. And when I am an advanced teacher, I will just revolutionize Zen by saying everybody can just, you know, sit in a comfortable chair. Because I really thought this was a superstition. I really did. I thought this is just like, you know, no sense trying to tell anybody, but this is like a superstition. But I realize now it's not a superstition, that, you know, when you sit down on a cushion and you straighten your back, it is challenging, you know. It's challenging to sit this way. But people can get into very, very deep concentration. And it's really very powerful. You know, meditation is very, very powerful. It's not just kind of like something you do to cut your stress 15 minutes a day. When people sit down on the cushion, they're assuming the posture of an enlightened person. And they're not yet an enlightened person, but they're assuming the posture. And again, that sounds like superstition. It sounds like, oh, so you're pretending to be a Buddha. You know, by sitting down on a cushion pretending to be a Buddha, you're going to become a Buddha. How laughable. But if you understand that the body is this instrument for achieving enlightenment, then sitting down on the cushion and being in the proper posture is really powerful. Processes in your body change when you sit down on the cushion. You know, your mental functioning changes. It doesn't take long for your mental processing to change, at first subtly and then dramatically. So even though all of this can seem quite strange, and all of this can be quite challenging, it's really a physical challenge to sit on the mat. You know, you definitely are changing many things. You know, when you get into deep concentration, your heart rate goes way down, and your breathing rate drops. And people have done endless studies on what happens to people's brains when they do this. You know, but you're definitely your brain is processing information very differently. Your brain waves become synchronized, and so on and so on. You know, I'm not. The Western way of understanding it is in terms of brain waves and in terms of, how the endocrine system is relaxing. But from the Buddhist standpoint, the traditional Buddhist standpoint as well, you know, this is changing your consciousness. You know, how you're perceiving the world is being altered. So it's very important to practice this regularly. You know, if you come to Sesshin and you don't practice regularly, this is a big shock to your system. It's like running a marathon without having practiced every other day or something leading up to it. It's challenging. But, you know, regular practice produces deep concentration. And when you get to a situation like Sesshin, you know, if you've been practicing regularly, you can get into samadhi very, very fast, you know. So please, if you're one of these people who doesn't practice and then you come to Sesshin, please make a place in your life for this kind of practice. It's so important to do regular practice, and it has many benefits for your daily life. But you know, when you come to Sesshin, you will be able to make really rapid progress. Please don't reject the fact that this is strange, and please understand that once you get into this process, you'll realize you can. There's no other posture I know of that allows you to be at once deeply relaxed and very, very alert. You know, like extraordinarily alert. You know, that is not possible, in my opinion, in any other kind of setting or position. So please work at it, and make a place every day, if you can, or often, for this practice. You know, this is day 4 of Sesshin. So many people came here on Tuesday night, and they've been working with their body minds and going through this process. You know, by around day 3 of Sesshin, you're in a very different mental place than the day when you came in, and this posture is really what makes that possible. You know, in some traditions of Zen, people put great deal of importance on absolutely perfect posture. Not our tradition, but there's another tradition of Zen called Soto Zen. And, you know, they actually work very, very hard to just be absolutely straight. They're supposed to be, their shoulders are supposed to be exactly at the right height. A person actually, at the start of each sit, goes around and monitors your posture. And if you're not sitting right, they'll straighten you up and yell at you if you're not sitting right. This is in a Japanese temple. And they work very, very hard to have like this absolutely picture-perfect posture. I don't really think that's necessary, but it's not just a superstition. When you put the body in the right condition, the mind enters the right condition. So it's very difficult to be concentrating properly if you're hunched over. It's very difficult to be concentrating, to be breathing properly if you're hunched over. So please understand that putting the body in the right position is really part of the deep, like you could say, spiritual practice. You know, so this is day 4 of Sesshin, and many people are, I would say everybody, is doing a wonderful job on the cushion. And I think part of the challenge of Sesshin is this idea of when you come to a Sesshin, your goal is enlightenment, right? Your goal is enlightenment. And that should be your goal. You know, I think if people lose confidence in the idea of awakening, enlightenment, eventually they just stop practicing. So, you know, a lot of people get into meditation for therapeutic reasons. You know, this definitely helps your life. But it's definitely the case that there is such a thing as enlightenment. You know, I have known many, many people, I would say, have had deep Daikensho experiences. All of my teachers had had that experience, and under difficult circumstances. You know, my teacher's teacher was a man named Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. And Yamamoto Genpo Roshi was a really interesting guy because he was born in like the lowest strata of Japanese society. And he was basically blind, you know. He had some vision, but he lost his vision, most of his vision, when he was like eight. He had like a high fever and lost his sight. And so, you know, he was like making his living, you know, like making brooms, that kind of a thing. And he decided that he heard somebody talking about like reciting a sutra. And he was so deeply moved by that, and he was so unhappy with his life, you know, that he decided to become a monk. And it was very challenging for him to function in a temple setting, you know. And he was quite old by the time he just started out in his training. He was like 55 years old, something like that. And he had all kinds, it's difficult to start doing this at that age. And it's much easier when you're young and you're very flexible and so on. But he had a great awakening experience and became this deeply inspiring figure. So he was the teacher of my first teacher, Genki Roshi. And Genki Roshi grew up in his temple. And Genki Roshi had been a war orphan. And he basically practiced for many years and had great awakening experience. And then my second teacher was an American who got interested in Zen after World War II. And he went to Japan just to study art history. He went to this temple because he wanted to do some research on a painting called The Five Persimmons, which is this famous, famous Japanese painting. And the abbot of the temple said to him, I won't even let you look at the painting if you don't do Zazen. So the abbot basically said, I will let you see the painting, but first you have to train and do Zazen so you understand what the painting is trying to communicate. So my teacher, Webb, started doing Zazen. And he said he really had a hard time. You know, he actually would have so much pain that he would sometimes throw up. You know? So I hope nobody's throwing up. But Japanese temples are very, very strict. And you have to sit full lotus every time. And if you aren't sitting full lotus, the temple boss will come over and basically put you in full lotus. You know? So they have this, in every community, even monks, there's somebody who's kind of a bully, right? So he's hired to be the sort of temple boss, and he goes around and yells at people and shapes them up and makes them get into full lotus. So this was so difficult for Webb that he would just go out and throw up sometime. Eventually, after many years of training, he had a great awakening experience. And then one day he was going out to the bathroom, and he looked down, and there was the scroll in the bathroom, and he opened it up, and it was the Five Persimmons. So there is such a thing as a great awakening. I have met many people who have that experience. But on the other hand, you know, if you, that should be a goal, right? That should be a goal of practice. And when people stop believing that there is such a thing as enlightenment, I think they stop, sooner or later, they just stop practicing. But on the other hand, it's also the case that if you are trying too hard to have a breakthrough experience, you know, you can make your session very unhappy, very unpleasant. And you can look back over your Zen life after many years and feel that nothing has been accomplished if you haven't had this big breakthrough, right? And as I was mentioning earlier in the week, you know, the koan collections are full of stories of people having a great awakening experience, right? So, you know, these stories are meant to inspire people, you know? So in one case, there's a story about a Zen monk who had been practicing for 20 years and had never had Daikensho. And then one day he is talking to this great Zen master named Linji, and Linji asks him a question, and the guy can't answer the question, and Linji slaps his face, and he has a great awakening experience. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another story of a guy who was practicing for 20 years, and he got so discouraged that he just left the temple. He said, "That's it, screw you, Zen's a fraud." And he went and lived in this little hut in the woods. And one day while he was raking gravel, according to the story, a piece of gravel flew up and hit a piece of bamboo. And when he heard the knock of the gravel against the bamboo, he had a great awakening experience, you know. So it's like story after story is about people having these flashes of these great flashes of insight. And the book is supposed to inspire you. You're supposed to say, okay, I want to have some of that action. You know, I want to have a Kensho experience, right? And so, you know, when I myself started doing Zen, I remember telling somebody that I was sure that if I was just going to practice for a couple of years, I said, I'm sure I can have an awakening experience. You know? So it was going to be, you know, I was going to get in, work, you know, do it, and then move on to something else, you know. So, you know, it's important that to understand that, you know, there is this experience, enlightenment. But on the other hand, if you come to Sesshin and you're single-mindedly trying to answer your koan, or you're single-mindedly trying to have a breakthrough on the cushion, you know, you won't get anywhere at all. And this is true for many things in life, right? If you set a goal for yourself too rigidly, you know, in life, you know, and you won't be flexible in pursuit in the unfolding of events, right? You know, so I was talking about this a little earlier in the week. You know, friends I know who you know, fulfilled their goals and then found themselves very unhappy. And, you know, Zen practice is like this too. You know, if you're always shooting for the, you know, if you're always grabbing for the ultimate prize, you know, everything feels like a disappointment. And this is a style of life that our culture encourages us to adopt, you know. So you know, basically we think in terms of winners and we think in terms of losers. This is commonplace in our culture. And that way of thinking is so destructive because, you know, actually there is no, in a certain sense, you know, there is no goal. You know, life really doesn't have a purpose, actually. You know, it's what makes life beautiful and interesting is the natural unfolding of things in the readiness of time. Right, that, you know. So I had a friend. He's still my friend, and he was. He began to get very depressed when he was in his late 20s because he wasn't married, and he would be dating all of these women, and you know, and they would, you know, back out or just never return his calls, and you know, he was beginning to get panicky because he felt like there was a timetable. All his friends were getting married, right? And he was still unmarried. And it was freaking him out, right? He was like, you know, another friend, he'd get another wedding invitation. Oh my God, you know, another one, you know. And he was feeling like he was a quote-unquote loser, right? There is a kind of social expectation, maybe, that when you're in your late 20s, you're supposed to get married, right? This is a common view. And if you're in your late 20s and you're not married, you know, maybe people say, well, you know, what's going on? Why aren't you married, you know? But the truth is, you know, many people who are married are actually unhappy. That's the truth. And there are actually unmarried people who are actually very happy. You know, and there isn't a book somewhere that says you have to get married at age 28 or you're a loser, right? You know, a more interesting thing is a better way to live is to be interested in people, right? Not necessarily be looking for a potential wife or potential husband, but actually just be interested in people, you know? And if you're interested in the natural unfolding of events, you know, it doesn't really matter if this is leading to matrimony. What's really important is that you're enjoying somebody's company. And if you enjoy somebody's company, the issue of marriage becomes really very secondary. You know? And some wonderful relationships don't end in marriage, you know? And some things that end in marriage don't turn out to be so wonderful. So you know, we have all of these expectations in our life that life is supposed to go a certain way, you know? Age 28, married. You know, in fact, my nephew and his wife got married a few years ago, and already people are going, when are you going to have children? They're like tapping their watches, you know. Where's the kids, you know? And her name is Hannah. She has, she has people sort of like going, well, when's the baby shower, you know? I think this is such a mistaken way to live, right? It shows a lack of trust in the process, right? If you're just exploring life with a generous and trusting spirit, many good things will come your way. And they might not be the things you expect, but if you're receptive and open, lovely things can come your way. You know, your life will be rich if you can live this way. And if you're pressuring yourself to conform to expectations, you're just creating all kinds of anxiety for yourself. And this is true also for, for other aspects of life. You know, when I was in graduate school, I was in graduate school with this guy named Larry Stone, who is now a famous wine steward. He's a sommelier. He's one of the most famous sommeliers in the United States. But, you know, when I was in graduate school, Larry Stone was in the apartment up above mine. And I'm a very slow writer, so I have to write and rewrite and rewrite. So when I was writing my papers for graduate school, I would write and write and write. And Larry could hear, you probably don't know, but there used to be a device called a typewriter. And you actually had to push the keys with your own fingers, right? And you had to push them down. There were actually little levers. It was like a very primitive device. You'd push this key, and a little lever would knock a little letter onto a piece of inked ribbon onto the paper, right? So, I'd be clacking away. My typewriter would go clack, 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 clack. And he could hear me upstairs. And it would freak him out. And he would come downstairs and he'd knock on the door. I'd say, hi, Larry, what's up? He'd go, are you writing again? Because he wasn't writing. And he felt terribly guilty, right? So, you know, it would drive him crazy because he had a writer's block. And I was writing all the time. But not necessarily good stuff. I was just a slow writer. But in his mind, I was like, the pages were just flowing out and it was brilliant, you know. And he was just, you know, and he would get so upset and distressed that he would go down to the pike downtown Seattle and just look in the wine. They had all these wine stores down there. And he would just browse the wine stores. And he got interested in wine. And he has a first-class mind, and he began to research wines, and he never did, you know, get his dissertation, but he went to one of these culinary institutes, maybe he went to Cordon Bleu, I think, you know, and then he became this famous. He won a competition in France. He was the first American ever to win this sommelier competition, where you know you have the there's a meal, a chef will prepare a meal in your exam, basically your PhD exam, is that you have to pick the right wines to go with the meal. So you have to get the right wine at the beginning, as the meal is going on, a dessert wine, and then something to finish the evening. And my friend Larry, he wiped out all the kind. He became the first American to win this award, you know. And he has a vineyard. He used to work with Francis Ford Coppola, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so his life has unfolded in a way he never could have predicted. You know, and it's been this wonderful life. Well, you know, Zen practice is like that too. You know, if you have a timetable, if you're tapping your watch, you know, I've been working on this koan for 2 sessions. You know, I'm a Zen failure, right? You know, that's not that you're just making yourself miserable, right? And it's so on Zen, right? I mean, basically, you know, part of practice is being open to what's unfolding in on the cushion. You know, so we're in this extraordinary, we're in this altered state of consciousness. It is, you know, meditation is an altered state of consciousness. We're stripping everything down to zero, emptiness, right? And then, you know, Zen is sort of like rebuilding our minds from the ground up, so that we experience the world in this radically different way, radically integrated way. You know, so Zen is tearing a consciousness down. You know, it takes you back to zero, emptiness. And then it says, you know, there's a koan that says, listen. You know, what's the sound? You know, what is, you know, why do you put on your 3-piece robe or 7-piece robe at the sound of the bell? You know, so just listen for a while. So you're learning how to hear from an undivided mind. You know, normally we're separated from the world, but when you are in deep mushin and then you hear, you become one with the sound. So it's like Zen training is rebuilding your consciousness from the ground up, and you're experiencing the world from the standpoint of somebody who doesn't feel separate from the world, but feels oneness with everything around her, see? So basically, you know, working on these koans is goal-directed in a certain sense, right? You know, the goal is to become this fully integrated being. You know, we say a Buddha, right? and that's the goal. But, you know, if you're too rigidly pursuing your goal, you can't be open to what's actually happening. You know, so if you expect the answer to be one thing, you know, you could, this happens to all people who train in Zen. You know, you give them a koan, and maybe the answer to the koan really is hearing something. And they'll come in and they'll say, I'll say, how's it going with your koan? They'll say, oh, terrible. I can't focus. There's this goddamn bird out the window, right? And he's driving me crazy, right? So, you know, that's a classic case, right, of somebody who's too goal-directed. But we all have to be, we have to go through this process again and again. We're always looking for what we think should be the answer, right? But the answer is often right there. We're not trusting the process, and we're not open to to what's happening, right? And if this is your story, don't blame yourself. That's why we have to do Zen training. You know, we humans create these little mental boxes, and we try to force everything into the box. And Zen is, you know, understands that this is, you know, part of what humans do. But we gradually, you know, push people out of the box. You know, so you know, it's important not to judge your progress. And it's very important to realize that, you know, there's no timetable for answering your koans. You do have to try. If you just say, well, I haven't been thinking about my koan all day, you know, nothing's going to happen. But you do have to work with the koan. You have to hold it in your mind as often as you can. But then you just have to focus on, you just have to be open to what's happening, You know, and often it'll take you by surprise. People will come into the Dokusan room and I'll say, what's happening on the cushion? And they'll say, oh, nothing. And I'll say, well, what? Just tell me what's been going on today. And they'll say, this happened. It's like, okay, well, that's the answer to your koan. So this is a part of Zen practice, is learning how to try but let go. Try but let go. You know, it's a little bit like in archery. You know, Zen often uses these terms from the martial arts, and there's this in Zen archery. There's a term called ki. That's where you take the bow and you draw the string back, right? You draw the string back. That's ki, like energy. When you prana or chi. So when you pull the string back, you're building up energy, right? You're storing energy in the string. And when you release the string, the arrow flies out. And that's kyo. That's letting go. See, so Zen practice involves a balance of ki and kyo. Ki and kyo. So yes, we have a goal, enlightenment, answering the koan, whatever. You draw your bow and then you let go. And then you have to say, where did the arrow go? Where is it? Where is the koan taking me? Where is it taking me? The koan is not, people so misunderstand koans. Koans are not puzzles that require, that there's an answer. So it's not like, I give you a koan and then you give me an answer and I look in up my sleeve, there's a little book and I check, That's how I got through algebra, but that's not how you get through Zen, right? You look in the back of the book at the answers, right? There's no answer book. The koan is taking you on a journey. And it's speaking to your unconscious and it's taking you somewhere. And you have to go with the koan. And most of the time when we have trouble with our koans, it's because we want to go one place and the koan is taking us in the other. Or because we think we should be going here, but the koan is trying to take us somewhere else. And that creates the sense of being blocked or unable to work through the koan. So the koan is leading you somewhere. It's like you shoot the arrow and then you just go over and see where the arrow landed. See, so in normal archery, you have a target and you shoot towards the bullseye. But in Zen, you shoot the arrow and then you go and find where the arrow is and you paint the bullseye around the arrow. See, that's Zen archery. Not as it's really practiced in Japan, but as I think it should be practiced. But that's koan practice. You trust the arrow. And the arrow is going to take you to the bullseye. Where the arrow lands is your answer, is your engagement, the place where you and the koan meet. See. So if you're looking at the bullseye, the bullseye on the stand at the end of the field, and you don't see your arrow, you think, well, I screwed that up. But if you look and see where your arrow landed, that's where your answer, so to speak, lies. You see. So a lot of Zen practice is just trusting in the process, and taking it one moment at a time. See, this koan is particle after particle of samadhi, particle after particle of samadhi. So, you just take it one step at a time, one moment at a time. This moment and this moment. And by the way, this is true for when you're in pain on the cushion too, right? If you think, if you're in pain and you're tired and you sit down and you say, oh my God, we have half an hour of sitting, I'll never make it, right? That's a classic of negative thinking, by the way. Right. But also, it's so counterproductive. What I suggest you do is just say, I just have to take it one breath at a time. So it's like you take this breath, And if you really take this breath, and you don't worry about anything else, and you get to the end of the breath, well, well done. And then you take another breath. This is how I do it. You know, I just have to get through one breath. I just have to get through another breath. I just have to get through another breath. And, you know, I just go into the blankness, and then I eventually come out, and then I think, okay, back into the blankness, and then I eventually come out, and then I go back into the blankness, and then I eventually come out, and I go back. And then I have to look at my watch to make sure we haven't been sitting for too long. See, so you know, you just keep taking it one, and you know, if you do that, you get to the end. In fact, the time can go like that. And it's not just a gimmick for getting through a sit. It's a way of life. You know, we only live, the past moment is gone, and the present moment hasn't come yet. So the all, you know, in a certain sense, you're only alive this moment. So you know, be here now, right? And don't project and don't look back. You know, so if you take it one step at a time, you'll find that the sits go very fast. You know, it's like walking a tightrope. You know, if you're walking a tightrope, you just have to get through this. If you know, just get through this step, this step, this step, this step. Pretty soon, you've crossed the Grand Canyon, right? If you start your trip across the Grand Canyon on the high wire and you think, holy crap, that's a long distance. I might fall. You know, you might as well just jump, right? Okay. So please don't do that. Don't freak yourself out like that. Don't psych yourself out like that. Just take it 1 minute at a time. But this is true for so many things. You know, you will meet lots of people in the Zen world who have been practicing for like 6 or 7 years. And, you know, you occasionally talk to them and they'll say, yeah, well, you know, I never had Daikensho. I guess I'm a Zen failure, you know, something like that. And that is such a terrible attitude. You know, and if you add, you know, Zen isn't, you know, even after you've had Daikensho, you still have to go back to your training. It doesn't really solve anything. You still have obstacles to work through, right? You know, the Dalai Lama does, as I mentioned, he does 4 hours of meditation a day. What's he up to? He's cleaning up his karma, just like everybody else. You know, it's important to realize there is, you know, this does transform your consciousness. And the people who feel disappointed if they practice for 6 years and haven't had Daikensho haven't been paying attention. They're still looking at the bullseye at the end of the field. You know, they've had many breakthroughs. You know, there isn't really such a thing as one Kensho. You know, people have Kensho after Kensho. It's an opening. Kensho means opening. So every time you work through an obstacle, that's a Kensho. You know, you open up and you close up a little bit. And you open up and you close up a little bit. And you open up and you close up a little bit. But each time you close up, you don't close up as much as the last time. See, so at the, you know, even people who are feeling like after 6 years they haven't had Daikensho, they've still changed a lot. They're still much more happier, more open, more generous and kind people. And I wonder how they got that way, see, by working through their obstacles. So, you know, one person I know had gone through all the training in Japan, finished, and had gone home. And he thought, well, I guess I'm never going to have Daikensho. And then he was leading a sesshin in Washington State. And he had his Daikensho there. His students thought he had a nervous breakdown, but he actually had a Daikensho experience. So, you know, you never know. But it's very important to be open to the possibilities of the moment, to be in this moment. And if you're fully in this moment and open to this moment, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, and you know, you will be so happy. So please practice particle by particle, particle